Well, I'm delighted to be with you tonight. I'm very encouraged on a Friday night that you have chosen to be here. There are obviously lots of things that compete for our time and attention in the world that we live in, and you've chosen to be here tonight. It's not easy to get across a big town on a Friday evening. I was telling Jeff and Brent at dinner tonight in Nashville, you just about don't try to cross the city on Friday evening, especially between about 4 and 7 o'clock. It's just not an easy thing to do. I thank you for being here. I appreciate what you're doing in the cause of the Lord and the kingdom of Christ. I'm very appreciative of the invitation to come and be with you. It's exciting to be with Jeff and Brent and their families this weekend to share in the studies that we're doing and to spend some time together. Men that I admire and respect so very, very much for their scholarship, for their ability to discern truth, and for their zeal in teaching it. I appreciate this church for what you are doing and what you have done through the years in standing for truth and proclaiming Christ here and in other places. And I'm thankful to be back with you. The first time that I was here, I believe Brother Leon Goff was preaching here, and that dates me somewhat. And I was back again a time or two after that. The last time, I guess, Curtis was here at that time. But I'm happy to be here tonight with Jeff and with Brent, with the elders, with all of you to talk about something that really is of great importance to the cause of Christ and to local churches all over this country. I told Jeff and Brent tonight when when I sent some potential topics for consideration, I told my wife, if this is just a perfunctory thing and Jeff actually is the one who's going to say, yeah, do that. I know which one he's probably going to pick. But if the elders pick, I think I know what they're going to ask for. And the reason is because I don't think the situation here in Houston is remarkably different from the situation in Nashville, Tennessee. That's not remarkably different from the situation in Tampa, Florida, or from Louisville, Kentucky, or from any other place in this country. Every local church, as we begin that exercise of appointing elders, looking among ourselves to find men who can serve the congregation in shepherding the flock. And congregations, when they are getting ready to appoint deacons, those men who are going to serve in some very special and important ways for the functioning of the body together. Every time we address those matters, we come face to face again with the reality that families matter. And aside from elders and deacons and congregational development and organization, I would just tell you that scarcely a week goes by that from one place or another, sad news comes about a marriage that's in bad trouble. About a husband who has lost his way. About a wife who has left her husband. Stories about children who have rebelled against their parents, or a child who has gone into the world. We're living in a time when in our culture, we have we have lost sight of, it seems, the very fundamental understanding of what constitutes marriage and what constitutes a family. And so now we have sophisticated, educated individuals who are publicly arguing with one another, trying to figure out if a person is really a person, if a human life is really a human life, if a marriage is for a man and a woman, or two men or two women, or for three and one, or for whatever. We're living in a world that more and more obviously has lost its way. And ladies and gentlemen, the Lord's church is feeling the pain of the cultural chaos that is all around us. The 16th century, Janneke Munsdorp was a young Dutch mother. She was in her 20s, and she had just given birth to her child. She was weeping as she wrote. But as she clutched that baby in her hands and held that baby close, with the other hand, she was writing these words, and she said, "I leave you here. Oh, that it had pleased the Lord that I might have brought you up. I would have been so pleased and gladly have done my best with respect to that. But alas, it seems that's not the will of the Lord. And now I'm writing this letter to you, and I hope that through these lines, I can cause you to remember that when you have grown up and attained your understanding, that you will endeavor to fear God and see and examine why and for whose name your father and I have both died." The year was 1573. She was a Dutch Anabaptist. She was being sentenced to death for her faith. She believed in adult free will baptism, and it was in conflict with the state religion. And now her child has been born. Her husband has already been killed. Her life was spared until the birth of her child because her persecutors thought, and rightly so, that it would be more painful for her to die if she knew she were leaving that child. But more than she desired life itself, she wanted her child to understand why her parents had died. And she wanted to leave to her child the testimony of her faith. I have to tell you very honestly, I have no idea how to advance the slide. This, the big button. Don't say that preachers can't learn. Thank you. Let me ask you something. If for whatever reason, if tonight we were to draw our last breath, have you ever thought about what's the legacy we would be leaving behind for our children? What is the testimony? What is the statement of life that we've given to the world? How is it
that in the years that we have lived, how is it that God has been glorified in our lives and in our families? And what legacy are we leaving that is going to glorify God after all of this? You remember in the Bible, over and over again, you read about the patriarchs as they approached their death. They would pronounce the blessing on the children one by one. In Genesis chapters 48 and 49 and 50, you know, when Jacob comes to the end of his life, he gets all of the boys together. That was a mess of boys. He gets them all together. And one by one, beginning with Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah and Dan, Naphtali, Gad and Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph and Benjamin, one by one he goes through speaking his last words to his sons. Life passes quickly. The psalmist said, 70 the years of life, maybe by reason of a strength, 80 years. That seemed old to me when I was just a few years younger. I thought, well, you know, 70, 80 years old this year. I can't even hardly say this. I'll say it the other way. Right now I'm 59, but in September it changes. And you know what? Every year seems to pass faster and faster. James said, come now, you that say, today or tomorrow, we're going into such and such a city, and we're going to stay there for a year. We're going to buy and sell. We're going to make gain. He said, well, what are you saying? What are you presuming here regarding your life? You do not know what is going to be on the morrow. Just a few weeks ago, I was finishing up a tour of duty, as it were. I had been in Italy a few weeks working with some folks there down in Rome, and then up north Italy, I was with Gianni Berdini. And I will tell you, as that work was coming to an end and I was in the last days, I thought, of my stay there and of my work there at that particular time, after preaching for the group there in Trieste on a Wednesday night and then going back to my place, and Johnny was at his house, and he went home and he prepared himself for the night and for bed, he and his wife. I went to my place. I was preparing for the night. Sometime during that night, he had an arterial rupture in his abdomen. Almost bled to death before he could be rushed to the hospital. He was taken into emergency surgery. He was placed into a medically induced coma. After 48 hours, they began to bring him out from under. And in 24 hours, he had another arterial rupture in his abdomen. And the doctor, after the surgery to stop the bleeding, he came out and he told us the second time, doesn't look good. I just can't say. I'll tell you something, folks. Just a few hours earlier on that Wednesday, we had been sitting around a table together, eating and talking and laughing, and we were enjoying life together. Life changes quickly. Just this week in this country, we've been reminded, as a brother in Christ, a fellow preacher of the gospel, has suddenly passed at the age of 59. We've been reminded that there are no promises on. What is the legacy that we are going to leave. I'm saying that we get one opportunity with our families to be a family, and to be a family according to the plan of God, a family that's going to glorify God in the way that it is structured, in the way that it behaves, in the way that it interacts with each other and with the world around it. And we're going to spend some time this weekend talking about how God intended that family would organize and that family would interact, both in marriage and in parenting, how all of that was to work. But I'm saying to you tonight, as we look at our families, if we were to leave now, what is the legacy that we've left with our children? I will say something, folks. If we're not careful, we are going to become culturally tainted in this world in which we live. And in our efforts to rush around and work long hours to give our children all things good, we need to be careful that we're not sacrificing the one thing that is best. And in our effort to give to them every kind of electronic gadget and computer and technology that's just going to change their lives forever, things that could be helpful to them, we need to be careful that we not neglect to give them the one thing that is essential for them. And in our pursuit of things that are going to give creature comforts and esteem to their lives, the physical and the material things, many things of which perhaps we did not enjoy ourselves, but we want our children to have, in the pursuit of the temporal things, we need to be very careful that we're not compromising things eternal. Let me ask you. If our children, who are living in the context of our families, if they do not grow up with a faith in God, with a love for Jesus Christ, with a commitment to serve in the kingdom, if they do not grow up with a saving relationship with God, I'm just asking you tonight, what else matters? Oh, I tell you, they got a great education. I'll tell you, they've been very successful in life. I'll tell you, they had a lot of things I never had when I was growing up. If our children miss heaven, what else matters? Someone said, we need to all have enough faith to get down on our knees and pray to God and say to Him, Lord, do whatever it takes. I tell you, it takes a lot of faith to pray that prayer. Whatever it takes. We need to be sure that we are leaving to our children the fruit, the sweet fruit of a godly home, a godly family in which they have cultivated in their own hearts a genuine personal, individual faith of their own. I'll tell you what's happening, folks. We are living in a culture in which in mainline churches in Christendom in this country, they have been seeing and reporting for several decades now a steady stream out of their religious bodies of young people as they were coming of age and abandoning or outright rejecting the beliefs of their parents. I'm saying to you that among the people of God, unfortunately, we are seeing more and more tears and more heartbreak of parents whose children have come of age and at some point have walked away from the Lord. Faith in God is not automatic. The fact that someone is born into a home where the mother is a Christian, the father is a Christian, both parents are a Christian, the fact that someone is born to Christians does not mean that they are going to grow up and be faithful to God. It is not an automatic given that that's going to be the case. In the book of Judges, in the second chapter, we're told that when the children of Israel came into the land, as long as Joshua was alive and all the elders of that generation, those who had fought, those who had seen the mighty works of the Lord, as long as they were alive, the people were faithful. But when that generation died, there arose a generation after them who knew not the Lord, nor yet the mighty works that he had wrought for Israel. What happened? These people had, that generation had a secondhand faith. It was a hand-me-down faith. They had grown up listening to and accommodating the beliefs and the conclusions of their parents, but when their parents were gone, they had nothing of substance to sustain them. And they immediately fell into apostasy, and they suffered for it. The one responsibility in the law that God hammered into the heads and the hearts of his people was the responsibility of parents to diligently teach the law of God to their children. I'm saying to you tonight, parents, I'm a parent. I have two children. They're both married. I have six grandchildren. Grandchildren all above average. But grandchildren. I'm one of six children in the family I grew up. Tell you something that we need to come to terms with. We cannot pass along to our children what we have not yet embraced for ourselves. The primary responsibility for the spiritual training and the faith building of children, God gave it to the mother and the father in the home, and he reminded them repeatedly of their sober responsibility to immerse the entire context of their family in the Word of the Living God. God said, I mean, let there be such immersion that you wake up in the morning talking about it. You go about your day living it. The last thing on your lips at night is your rehearsal of it. And if you see the light of a new day, you wake to praise God and talk about it again. I'll tell you something that we find out in a far too painful way, folks. Our children can grow up in our homes, and they can show up in our assembly places, but it does not necessarily mean they have taken up our faith. And the reason is because every individual has to cultivate and develop a faith of his own in Jesus Christ. And the responsibility and the privilege of parents in the home in glorifying God is to help children cultivate and develop that faith. And so, in doing so, we create the context of a home environment that's going to be conducive to the knowledge of God, to the glorification of God, to the exaltation of God. Is God exalted in your home? Is God revered in your home? Is God praised in your home? Is God central in your home? Your children know. Children know what's important in their homes. I tell you, we can put on our happy faces, and we can put on our assembly smiles, and we can come in, and we can greet each other, and we can shake hands, and we can go through all the motions that we go through when we come together. But I'm saying to you, our children who are living in the context of our homes, they know. They know what is important in that home. They know what matters. They know what comes at the top of the priority list. They know when push comes to shove and something has to give, they know what's going to give and they know what is going to stay. They know. Let me ask you something. As we seek to create a family that's going to glorify God, if our children grow up to imitate us, to follow our example at home and in the world, if our children grow up to be like us, is God going to be glorified by that? Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 1, the writer said, the preacher said long ago, a good name is better than precious oil. Folks, we're living in one of the most superficial cultures of all time. Superficial. Who's going to help our sons and daughters understand the value of having a good name, a solid reputation, to be of sterling character? Who's going to help them understand the value of that? They are living in a world where false, manufactured, counterfeit images are slung all over the media. Into our living rooms. And I'm saying to you, somebody's got to help them understand the value of the genuine article, of the real thing. Our children see our examples. Our children hear our words. They hear what we talk about at home. They hear how we laugh together. They hear what we think is funny. They understand what constitutes entertainment in this house. They get all of that. And it's not because 5 nights a week we sit them down at 6:45 and we have a 45-minute class with them and we say, now, let's go over this again. The 10 things that we do for entertainment here in the order of importance. It's not that. They get it by experience. They get it because they live there. They get it because they have eyes and they have ears and they are in that home. I want to ask you something. If our children grow up with the same values and the same standards and the same behaviors and the same actions and reactions as we have, is God going to be glorified by that or not? Do you want your child to grow up and treat, if you have a son, dads, you want your son to grow up and treat his wife the way that you treat his mother? Because he sees how you treat your wife. How many people do you know who have gotten into real trouble in life because they couldn't handle their anger appropriately? Children and adults. And how many people do you know who have had to, by law, by court order, had to take anger management classes? And how many people do you know who live on a fairly regular basis in the context of screaming and yelling and tears and anger in the home environment in which they live? And I'm saying to you tonight, we need to be very, very careful about what goes on behind closed doors. About what goes on when we leave a building like this and we go back home and the garage door closes behind us. We need to be very careful because our children very often grow up to reflect the same attitudes and the same behaviors. God said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 19, he said, one of the reasons I have chosen you is this, because I know that you are able to influence your children, to command your children to walk in my ways after you. I wonder if God would say that about us. We need to ask ourselves sometimes, folks. If my child grows up to be the same kind of dad that I have been, is he going to be a good dad? If my daughter grows up with the same attitude toward her children that her mother has shown toward the children, is that going to be a good thing? If my son grows up and every time he gets angry, sometimes justifiable, sometimes not, every time he gets angry, he acts just like I act when I'm angry, is that going to be good or bad? And I'm saying, we need to think long and hard about the example that's being set in our homes. Ladies and gentlemen, we can We can clean it up for each other 2 or 3 hours a week when we get here. And we can clean it up when we get out in front of certain other people. Our children live in the context of the reality of our homes. And the real test of whether or not God is being glorified in that home is going to come when they leave that home. It is a fact that their faith is going to be challenged when they leave our home. But it's a question of whether or not God's going to be glorified. In Genesis chapter 39, Joseph found himself far away from home. He's been sold into slavery. He's expatriated into a foreign country. His brothers seemingly hated him. They were going to kill him. They sold him into slavery. His father never came to get him later. He finds out his father thought he was dead, killed by a wild animal. Joseph's in a foreign land. He's serving a foreign master. He's owned by a foreign political figure. And he was put in a situation where his moral upbringing was challenged to its very depth. And Joseph showed himself to be a young man of integrity, far away from home. Do you remember in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, when the writer of Hebrews begins to tell us about Moses, he doesn't start off with Moses. He starts off with Amram and Jochebed. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a goodly child and they were not afraid of the king's commandments. Do you see that? They were not afraid of the king's commandments. Well, a lot happened after that. By faith, Moses, you remember, his mother hid him in the edge of the Nile. That Pharaoh's daughter found him. He was taken to the palace, raised as the prince of Egypt. When he's 40 years old, he killed the Egyptian. He fled into the wilderness. 40 more years, he's 80 years old. God speaks to him from the bush and says, go back and tell Pharaoh to let my people go. The text says, when he came of age, in verse 24, by faith Moses, when he was grown up, he was 40 years old. If you have a teenager, don't give up. By faith Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season, accounting the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked unto the recompense of reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Wow, does that sound familiar? Look back in verse 23. By faith, Amram and Jochebed hid their child because they were not afraid of the king's commandment. Years later, away from home, away from his parents, what does it say about Moses? He forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Then there was Timothy, who grew up in a mixed household. His mother and grandmother were Jewish, but his father was a Greek. And there's every reason to think and to assume that this is going to be a less than ideal home life. This is a less than ideal circumstance. This is a less than ideal childhood for Timothy. Let me say something to you tonight. You probably know somebody right now who is in a less than ideal situation. And I'll tell you what a godly mother did. And a godly grandmother. They instilled the Word of God in the heart of that little boy. And as he came of age, he had a faith of his own and he took his stand and he served the Lord Jesus Christ. And I'm saying to you tonight that we need not despair. We need not despair. We find ourselves in a foreign country owned by a political figure. We find ourselves in a situation where we've been taken away from our parents and we are serving in the palace of the king. We find ourselves in a household where our mother is Jewish and our father is a Greek. And I'm saying to you tonight, God is able to deliver us. And He is able to deliver His children, and He is able to bring us to the very place He wants us to be. God is able to overcome less than ideal circumstances. Ladies and gentlemen, in closing, let me just say to you again, if God is going to be glorified in our homes and in our families, if God is going to be glorified in our marriages, if God is going to be glorified in our parenting, we've got to get serious about what God said regarding His will as I stand here tonight. I am thinking in my mind and weeping in my heart regarding situations right now in which a man, a husband, is not doing what is right toward his wife. Right now, I'm thinking of a situation where a young mother and three children are being abandoned by a husband who is caught up in the world and has just decided, I just don't want to be part of that anymore. It's just not me. Thinking about a situation where a young woman who grew up in a home much like all the homes represented here, living in a home that looks much like the homes represented here, who's been living a life of duplicity. Caught up with. I'm thinking about a situation. Where a 16-year-old boy is struggling for his life right now. Because just recently, he announced to his parents and to his brethren, not only that he was leaving the Lord, but that he no longer believes in God. Period. And yet the reality of his life, you want to know how that's working out for him? Not very well. Because in that downward spiral that he's involved in, he seems to be going faster and faster and faster, but his life seems to be disintegrating more and more and more. And I'm saying to you tonight, we are kidding ourselves if we think that we are going to casually live in this present culture and that somehow we're not going to be affected by the assault on the family and the home that has taken its toll on so many in the world and is gaining a foothold from time to time into the homes of those who are bearing the name of Jesus on their lips. And so I'm saying to you tonight, our privilege is to come to Him who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we think or ask. To come to Him to find our instruction, to find our help, to find our encouragement, and to know that with God all things are possible. And as long as God gives us life and breath, and as long as God gives our spouses life and breath, as long as God gives our children life and breath, our parents life and breath, as long as God gives us opportunity, we will not give up hope. But we will keep working. We will keep praying. We will keep striving. We will keep pleading. And we will continue to bow our knees before the Father who refused to give up on us. And we will rejoice in the blood of the Lamb that is able to take us where we are and wash us clean and make us whole again. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, our prayer for you is that you would this very night come in obedience to the gospel. If you've never confessed the name of the Lord and been united with Jesus in baptism, you can do that this very night. And if you are a child of God sitting here tonight, and in your heart of heart right now, in your heart of hearts, you know that your relationship with God is not what it ought to be. And maybe it has something to do with your marriage relationship. Maybe it has something to do with your parenting relationship. Maybe it has something to do, young person, with your relationship with your parents. Maybe it has to do with duplicity in your life.
saying to you tonight, you don't have to leave here. You don't have to leave here with that empty void in your heart. You can this very night taste the riches of the goodness of God in Jesus Christ. Won't you come while we stand and sing?